Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Radio Live 101.3 KPCG. Coming up on today's program, can a divided America survive? That's the question a lot of people are asking today. We have a write-up about that we'll take a look at. Also, some good news, potentially, with drones. They are carrying defibrillators that could aid heart emergencies, so that's a good use of technology. And also, an interesting write-up about the new Churchill movie and how they are basing that character, what they're basing it on. That and more, this edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. We have a live link at thetrumpet.com as well. And you can follow us on Twitter if you'd like to at kpcgfm and email us any comments you have, comments at kpcg.fm. I'm Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondeau here today. And, of course, the news has been full of what happened yesterday with the shooting where there was that shooting there in Virginia. We were talking about it just after it happened here yesterday on Trumpet Radio Live. And this is from Fox News in relation to that. Scalise critical as shooting stokes fears of rhetoric-fueled violence. So this is what they were talking about on the talk shows yesterday, the same talk shows that a lot of times have the rhetoric. And they were trying to it was an interesting day because you had different cable outlets that a lot of times do kind of stoke up the rhetoric covering this story and then trying to sort of backtrack on their rhetoric. I don't know. Did you guys see any of those programs?
Definitely. And you know what's even more blatant, obviously, is the amount of celebrities who are doing the same thing. I saw an article about 15 or 20 specific examples within the last few months where well-known celebrities, famous to millions or even billions of people, have issued public calls for violence against all Republicans or just Mr. Trump or whomever else they might think is worthy of targeting.
Yeah, I was watching a show yesterday. They were covering the events, and they had put together a little montage in the beginning of all the celebrities and what they've said and what they've done. And it's pretty bad, especially when you see them all one after the other. And again, when it goes from just being a bunch of talk to somebody takes action, that's where people start maybe backtracking a little bit. This write-up here from Fox News says Hodgkinson, who is the shooter, belonged to a Facebook group called Terminate the Republican Party and apparently maintained two Facebook pages that featured angry and sometimes violent rants against President Trump. He was a volunteer for Senator Bernie Sanders, the Vermont Independent, who called Hodgkinson's rampage a despicable act. A number of anti-Trump Facebook posts taken down Wednesday by the social media giant were published to the page that appears to be Hodgkinson's just 2 days before the shooting. And they talked about those messages talked about Trump being guilty, should go to prison for treason. Another one said, you know, to make America great again, he should resign. So I thought it was interesting that they pulled him down yesterday. You know, if they were fine the day before, why are they not fine now? Obviously, it's because of the action, but you have to stop and kind of think, well, if it's okay to say something, isn't it always okay? Or if it's not okay, isn't it always not okay? Like, what's the dividing line between what stays on these social media platforms and what's taken off?
Yeah, I think the really big question now is accountability. How are people being held accountable for their words, what they're inciting, or on social media, what people post? And there's been lots of instances where Facebook and other people have been blocking or taking away funding for more conservative websites or even news, conservative opinionated news, even having a lot harder time reaching it. But something like this can remain up there until after disaster strikes. And so there needs to be some kind of policy or guideline or Just the leaders of this nation need to tone things down and tell people to tone down and lead by example.
It's tough. I mean, people do have a free speech right, I guess, but sometimes they can cross the line.
You can't issue a call for violence, though, and that's why legally they should be held accountable for saying things like that. Do you really think that people who have influence on the lives of millions of people can't influence a single person by calling for violence? It's highly unlikely that that would be the case.
Yeah, somebody made the example or gave the example yesterday of the fact that it's illegal to yell fire in a theater.
Exactly.
Same sort of issue if it gets to be serious in terms of what people are calling for. But it's been violent. There's been violence happening. Here's a few examples. Earlier this month, bricks were hurled and a gas bottle thrown at police officers who were trying to quell the violence between groups of demonstrators, both supporting and opposing President Trump, when they converged in downtown Portland. You probably remember seeing some of this on the news. Police arrested at least 14 people and confiscated various weapons, including a knife, brass knuckles. People still use brass knuckles, huh? And a homemade slingshot used to launch balloons with some sort of foul liquid in it. Other examples from college and high school classrooms to protests on town squares have seen political speech cross into calls for violence. A Fresno State University professor said that the president had to hang. He wrote that on Twitter shortly after the election. And another one said some things about assassinations. There was examples of teachers in high schools placing bets about assassinations, things like that. So those are the teachers of the young people, whether it be college professors or high school professors or high school teachers. And so those are just some of the examples, and there's been a lot more than that. And so and then yesterday when you see somebody actually take action, now everyone's a little bit, well, at least stopping for a moment to think about it. But I don't think this will stop anything yesterday. I think it'll maybe slow the rhetoric down for a day or two, and I bet we're right back on the same old talking points not long after.
Yeah, well, if you call your movement the resistance, it doesn't suggest that they're going to surrender or stop even when something like this happens. And I remember, well, there's the gruesome Kathy Griffin photo shoot, and then right before that, the rapper Snoop Dogg had a video of him shooting an effigy of Donald Trump in the head. So there's things like that, too, where they're implying something, implying violence and murder. And even saw a tweet from Joe Scarborough from MSNBC today criticizing Newt Gingrich for having insensitive language. It's just making the situation worse and worse. Because he said something about the special counselor. So, and to me, that's ridiculous that he, of all people, should accuse Newt Gingrich of that when he's been saying a lot of things he probably shouldn't have been saying on that show. But anyway, it just shows that as long as they're not willing to budge or negotiate or have some kind of open discussion with the president, that's what democracy is supposed to be in the first place, I don't see this problem clearing up, and it's only going to have become more extreme.
And then yesterday, too, I mean, this was the top story for most of the day, but then at the end of the day, they came out and said the president's going to be investigated, I guess, for obstruction of justice in this great Russian mystery that's unfolding. And I thought it was just sort of bizarre timing. Like, you think you'd give it a day or two, but they're right back into the real negative stories about the administration. Not that, I mean, if they want to do that, that's their right, I guess, to proceed. But at the same time, you'd think just on a day when somebody acted out very violently, you'd just maybe wait a second. But they decided not to, so that story was out there. So it is interesting, and but it's big business too in terms of these breaking news stories and all this political talk. This is a write up from Variety that Abraham, you saw. Cable news wars inside the unprecedented battle for viewers in the Trump era. The numbers are up across the board for all of these news channels: MSNBC, CNN, Fox News, CNN. They all have bigger numbers than they've ever had, and they, you know, it's a moneymaker for them. So for them, it's good business to keep the fires going a little bit,
You know, it's funny. I actually read this morning that MSNBC and Fox News are located in the same building in New York. I don't know about all the other broadcasting stations, but it's just awkward to know that they go into the same building and then just take the elevator to different floors in the same building, knowing that MSNBC is pretty far left at this point and that Fox News is classified as far right, but that might be debatable.
Yeah. They say due to this write-up from Variety says, due to controversy swirling around the Trump administration, which I find interesting if you just stop and think about that sentence. What controversies exactly? The media is talking about, right? And nothing's come out that's really stuck yet. But then if you look at the past administration, where there, you want to talk controversies. I mean, there were controversies on top of controversies and controversies about the controversies. And yet, a lot of the outlets were saying, oh, everything's fine. No drama here. No problem here. But now there's a lot of controversy. So, but there's not really a lot of controversies, is there? Other than what the media is trumping up, no pun intended, to get this whole ball rolling. And so the fact that they just throw that out there like that's a given. Oh, yeah, you know, all the controversies. I just think that shows the, well, the leaning of this article from Variety, but also just the agenda of a lot of these cable news outlets. Why wouldn't you want it to keep going? Because you're making money, you're getting viewers.
You know, they could get a lot of viewership just from covering the scandals of the last administration, too. So in a way, they could be hurting themselves simply by not pursuing one side but pursuing the other. While they have many hours a day talking about the Trump-Russia scandal, they're ignoring the fact that Barack Obama basically shut down foreign intelligence services that would harass Iran's terror network so that basically the Iran nuclear deal could go through. It wouldn't frustrate the Iranians. They didn't want to frustrate the Iranians by looking out for terrorism that could harm the U.S. So he told them to stand down, basically. That's a pretty big scandal. Obviously, the ransom payment of $400 billion to get a few prisoners back. Those things are finally coming out, and a lot of pretty big scandals have come out even since he left office. Just the fact that he has something like 30,000 staff members there in Washington, D.C. Why would he need all of those people unless he were trying to run some kind of a big operation there as well?
Yeah, there's definitely been plenty to cover over the last few years, but now people seem more interested, I guess, at this point in some of what they're talking about currently. They say in this fraught atmosphere, it's no surprise that combined viewing of the big three cable news networks, Fox News, Channel CNN, and MSNBC, is up 33% through the first week of June compared with the same period last year, according to the data. And, of course, that sort of flies in the face of the cable-cutting generation that we're in, where people don't watch television as much, at least in some for some things, but not when it comes to the nightly news. But they say it feels like many nights feel as momentous for the future of the country as election night. That's the atmosphere and the feeling. And so in this article, they go through and talk about these different staffs on these news shows, how many hours they're working. They don't take vacations anymore. I mean, because every night's a big night, and it's, you know, they're really trying to win the numbers and win the views. And, of course, Fox News has been on top for 15 years, and they're starting to maybe descend a little bit from their top spot, even though overall they're still the number one news channel. But they the other companies feel like they might have a shot. So if you're working, for those that are working for one of those those news programs, it's a lot of overtime.
It's a big problem, too, because news stations are not supposed to be focused on ratings. That's basically a relatively new phenomenon that has taken place in the last 30 or 40 years. I believe it even started with CBS News. They ran kind of like a precursor to Baywatch, basically, where they had some sort of a spring break special. And obviously it had just scores of scantily clad women. The viewership was through the roof, as you could imagine. And so they said, oh, this wasn't really much of a news program at all, but we got a lot of viewers, and that means a lot of money. And then because of basically one program, it all just started to spiral into that kind of a chase for ratings.
Yeah, they're chasing them for sure. That's what they're after today. Big advertising dollars, and so it's a time where they feel like they can get more and more viewers, and the competition's for those viewers is hotter than ever.
Yeah, I think what each of the CEOs of these news stations are looking for is they're all waiting for the Saturday Night Massacre, or in other words, the big event that happens in the Trump presidency where they can just like what happened with President Nixon. They can have all the reporters, they can nail President Trump and have their moment of victory. I think that's why they're treating the news in such a way, because it seems like they're building up to the climax of the drama, to where they can say, we got you moment.
Right.
And then they can have their victory lap. And so I think they're all waiting for some big historic event to happen on the news. The problem is it's all fabricated, and all the big historical events are happening outside the United States. I mean, there are big things happening here, but by deliberately fueling this fire to keep viewers, they're missing all the big news stories around the world that are pretty earth-shaking, that are very important, and they're just neglecting that reporting just so they can get more viewers and so they can, in most cases, propagate some kind of agenda as well.
That also reveals a pretty disturbing change in the viewers themselves, because people used to watch the news simply to be informed, and it didn't matter if one side was feeding your preconceived notions and stoking your anger about issues, basically confirming what you already believed. Now that's what people go to the news for in a lot of cases. They want to hear confirmation of the things they believed already, instead of hearing an unbiased, straightforward report and then forming their opinions that way.
It is reality TV, a lot of the viewers say. They said this is the best reality show there is. Politics, watching the back and forth between the different sides. So it's interesting, and later we're going to have a story about the divided America, and we'll talk about that as well. Yesterday, after the program, Abraham and I, we were having a little chit-chat, and we ended up on the conversation of dogs for some reason. And I made a passing comment that I've had this nightmare, this thought, you know, that somehow I'll end up running through the woods in Russia being chased by dogs. Just I think I've seen it in a movie or something. Scary. It's a scary event.
So I think I've had the same one.
Yeah.
That's really strange.
Well, I saw this story, and I was kind of tied into that. And this has a happy ending. A boy who is 4 years old, so think about being four, found alive after spending 5 days alone in bear-infested forest in Russia. So this boy lived it, and he survived it. A boy aged four has been found alive after spending 5 days alone without food in a bear-infested forest in Russia. His name is Dima Peskov, and he was on a camping trip with his parents in the Refkinsky Reservoir near some Russian place. Yekaterinburg, 900 miles east of Moscow, so somewhere out there. And he became separated. They went to get some firewood, and the boy told his dad, he said, "I'm tired. Can I go back to where mom is?" And the dad should have said, "You just pick up this wood like I told you," but no. He sent him back to his mom. It wasn't that far away, like 50 meters, but the boy got lost, got turned around in the woods, didn't know where to go. Mm. And so they lost him. And then thankfully they found him, though, 5 days later. Hadn't eaten, ticks, bug bites. He ate grass to survive, but he survived.
How did they not just yell for him or something like that? That's just really hard to imagine.
I don't know. He must have, I don't know how thick the forest was, or maybe he just really got far away from them. They end up having this huge search, and with 300 police and volunteers, and thankfully they found the guy. But the doctor said he was dehydrated, had insect bites, and he may have contracted pneumonia. They say, but he was otherwise fine, which is funny. Yeah, dehydrated, insect bites and ticks and pneumonia. Other than that, you're okay. Other than that laundry list of problems. But at that age and for that long, and the fact that there were bears out there, because they brought dogs out to try to find him, and the dogs they found the bears. So the fact that he survived it, they found him he was slumped by a hole under a felled tree near a swamp, just sitting there. Parents must be relieved. That's an amazing survival tale.
Yeah, it's should call him Lord of the Bears. But that's it's always unfortunate. I mean, this had a happy ending, but this happens a lot. I remember a story about a man. He parked his car on the side of the road, and he went to the forest for something. I forget what it was. And he got turned around, and he died in the forest. And he was literally only about 50 feet from his car, but he couldn't find it. And he just got turned around and disoriented and started panicking, and he died like really close to where he started.
It's amazing.
But I remember I got lost in the woods once and started crying, and my eventually I stumbled upon my sister, who was watching me through a bush the whole time.
And laughing at you.
Yes. Yeah. But then when I went there when I was older, you could see the house from where I got lost. So I was a little confused at how I get lost. Like, you can see the house and the road and like these huge lights shining everywhere. So I don't know. Maybe I wasn't very old, but stuff happens.
Oh, it could happen. Yeah. Not a couple years ago, my son and I, we were just walking around in a local park, but there's a pretty good wooded area. And there's some, like, kind of trails you could take through there that people just made. And he's like, Dad, you know, can we go through one of those? I said, yeah, sure. So we start walking around. Same sort of thing. I'm like, how do I get out of here? You know, eventually we did. It wasn't that big of a deal. But you do have that moment of, like, am I going to ever get out of here? I'm in the middle of a park in a city, and I can't find my way out. So some people are very good at navigating. Others are not. And you have to be careful if you're camping, going out into the woods. But thankfully, the boy was okay. Today is the 15th of June. Here's a couple of things that might be interesting historically. The Magna Carta.
Well, there are people who say it the way you said it just now.
Yeah, that was it. That was an accident. 1215, King John signs Magna Carta at Runnymede near Windsor, England. So that's a huge monumental event and a monumental document. Here's a trivia question for you related to this day in history. What's the oldest national flag? Any ideas?
In the world?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to say some place in Africa or the Middle East.
Denmark.
So, I was way off.
That's what they claim. So I don't know. Maybe somebody has another one. But they say the flag of Denmark on this day in 1219, that's when it began. According to the legend, it fell from the sky during a battle. So I don't know about that. But in any event, that's where the flag of Denmark started in 1219. And 1775 on this day, George Washington was appointed commander-in-chief of the American Army. A lot of things happened on June 15th, a pretty monumental day.
Yeah. In fact, it's my parents' wedding anniversary as well.
There you go. How many years?
32.
Wow.
So I'll have to add that to those websites online. Of course, the most important is probably Magna Carta being signed, and I have an article on the Trumpet about that that was written for the 800th anniversary, which was 2 years ago. Monumental event, and I think just the lessons about the rule of law and basically overcoming tyranny through institutional government, those lessons and the principles are being thrown away right now in all our democracies. So it is interesting to ponder on history and to see that it has survived for 802 years, but we're starting to see it basically unravel at the seams.
Yeah, for sure. We'll talk about that here in a minute. You're listening to Trumpet Radio live here on 101.3 KPCG. Key of David program is coming up in a bit, also the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Make sure you check that out. Also stop and check out thetrumpet.com, the feature story today. Was an image of Jesus discovered in Rome's catacombs. That rhymes. painting, statues, and movies utterly fail to depict the appearance and character of Jesus Christ. Related to that, science asks, what did Jesus really look like? And two views of Jesus Christ. That's always an interesting topic. You can find out more about that at thetrumpet.com. Speaking of being in catacombs, there was a few teenagers that got lost in some catacombs over, I think it was London. For like three nights, something like that, they got turned around or something, got stuck under there. So there's been people getting lost lately, but found, I guess. That's how we know that they got lost in the first place.
Yeah, that'd be terrifying to be lost in a catacomb. I mean, because that's, especially, the biggest one in the world's underneath Paris, I believe.
I think that's where it was, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. But yeah, just, there's like bones everywhere and just unburied skeletons. And that would just be the worst possible place to get lost, I think.
Right. Yeah, that's right. I said London, didn't I? Paris, yeah. I believe, is where it was, yeah. Grant, you've got a write-up for us here from the Washington Examiner. This is about your favorite basketball team, the Warriors.
I love them.
It says, if the Warriors skip a visit to Trump's White House, they'll be taking a play from ESPN's failed playbook. I guess they don't know for sure if they'll go or not, but they are pretty anti the current administration, at least some of the players and coaches.
Right. It's one of those situations where it's hard to imagine if they didn't go, because it's been such a longstanding tradition, and I can't think of any team that has ever turned down a visit to the White House in the last 30 or so years since this became a regular tradition under Ronald Reagan. But at the same time, it's hard to imagine them going because they've all said a lot of pretty vile things about the president.
Yeah, it's become fashionable, I guess, lately to kind of protest the president by not going. And it's interesting, though. It depends on which administration you do it under, how the media responds to that. I believe there's been some that didn't want to go see President Obama, and I don't think that went over very well in terms of the media. And but now I think they would be a little more open to this decision if the Warriors, in fact, don't go. Of course, they're from a very, very progressive area, as they would call it. They're in the San Francisco area. So they definitely would be fitting into the mood of that part of the country anyway.
Right. They would at least be appealing to about half the country. The safer move, it would seem, though, would be to keep to the status quo. It doesn't mean you're necessarily in favor of all the president's policies, but at least you're not necessarily going to alienate anyone by doing the same thing that's been done for 30 or more years. But it's funny, this article calls them these woke warriors. So they apparently, they're just sarcastically saying that they are so good at basketball that obviously they should try their hand in politics as well.
Right.
With the coach focusing a lot on some of the mean things that Mr. Trump has said during the campaign, and then some of the players saying that they individually wouldn't go even if the team itself had accepted the invitation. And that has happened before. Certain players haven't gone for various reasons, rarely for political statements, but for family issues or whatnot. The team can't necessarily force all the players to make it to that one scheduled date, but they can definitely accept the invitation and try to show a little bit of class in this era where there isn't a whole lot of class being shown by anybody.
Yeah, I think it should just be to honor the office of the land, and it is a tradition, like you said. And you don't have to agree personally with everything that that president or the current administration does, but you can still go and get your, I don't know what they do, shake hands. You should give them a jersey or something like that. But that is like this article is saying here. That line between just sports and entertainment and then politics is really blurred lately, to where all of a sudden everybody's a political expert, I guess, or wants to make a protest out of things. Because, it's interesting. If you can't really go through life that way, particularly in a country like the U.S., you're going to run into all sorts of people that probably have a little different viewpoint than you may personally. And if you say, well, I won't go there, that guy doesn't think like me, well, you're not going to go a lot of places, probably. I mean, even in a basketball game, do all the officials agree politically? Or the fans, do they all agree? Of course not. But you don't refuse to go play. You don't refuse, typically, right? So it's just, you can't really take that type of stance in life. I would agree with a stance like that if, say, it was a terrorist. But we don't often even see that happen. Usually they don't protest those types of things. But hopefully they just go and don't make too big of a deal out of it.
Yes, I hope so. That would be the pleasant outcome of all this, but it does seem highly unlikely that they will. There were some unsubstantiated reports that they had all voted unanimously, player by player, not to go to the White House. It's funny because none of those reporters ever challenged them, like, what do you not like about him? What has he ever said specifically that you think is racist? They always just go right along with it, and then they write their stories that say, well, the president's terrible, these guys said. But they can now substantiate it with someone else's quotes instead of saying what they clearly believe themselves.
Yeah, it would be you wouldn't want to be that one guy in the locker room that does want to go. You're like, well, I'll go. So you're the only guy that represents them there at the White House.
Well, I think it shows a lot of arrogance. I think to not accept, it's an invitation. You're not honoring the president with your presence by being there. It's a great privilege to go into the White House and be able to be in the first office of the land. So I just think it's a foolish opportunity. I think to me, it's just really arrogant to think that you're better than the president and the office and the government of the land when you play sports. I mean, that's basically not a job. I mean, it is in this society, but I know a lot of them do other things, but still, it's just, I think, completely out of perspective.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if they do that or not. And they reference that ESPN's failed playbook here. I guess they're talking about just the fact that they try to occasionally get out of sports and get into the politics, and people don't like that crossing of those two very separate fields.
That was a humorous yet accurate analogy. They were saying that the Warriors have exercised the same political finesse of ESPN, which Colin Cowherd, who now works for Fox Sports 1 but used to work for ESPN, said that what ESPN is trying to do is like mixing tuna fish and ice cream. You might like sports and politics separate, but you would never want to mix the two. A lot of people are just disgusted at the fact that any time a team mentions boycott in the White House, or even if a few players from the New England Patriots say they don't want to go, those different sports shows use it as a chance to spend an hour talking about how evil the president is in their eyes. That's really not what people tune into the ESPN for. And they also compared, well, this article also compared their political finesse to Jimmy Carter boycotting the 1980 Olympics because Russia rolled its tanks into Afghanistan. So it cost a lot of people, a lot of Americans, the opportunity to be in the Olympics that year.
Yeah, well, it'll be interesting to see what happens there with Golden State. And then, of course, this is getting into the it's the NBA offseason, all the trades and the drafts and everything, and everyone's trying to take down the super team. So
they're a charming bunch, aren't they? They have possibly ruined all semblance of competition in the league for the next decade, and now they're going to try their hand at politics as well. They really do care a lot about what people think. But to be fair, Klay Thompson, I believe in February, actually said he would like to go.
Yeah.
So clearly it doesn't seem like there would be a unanimous decision on that, if at least Klay Thompson has said something to the contrary pretty recently. He said he'd like to go to see the history of it and to see the president and to walk the halls where so many things have taken place. And that's really the way that most people should think of it too. That's what Kobe Bryant said he would do as well.
Yeah, and I my personal feeling just is that most of these players actually don't have any big issue. It's just the peer pressure. They just are pressured by the media, and they know the temperature of the environment, and they don't want to, they're just giving into the peer pressure and doing what they think is the popular thing. But like you said, Grant, I think if you really pinned them down and said, okay, you tell me exactly what your big problem is, I don't think they'd have anything. I mean, they'd have some generalities that they heard maybe on TV, but if you said, okay, well, what specifically do you mean by such and such, I don't think they'd have a lot. So I think it's just peer pressure. You know, if all of a sudden all the entertainers and the different people that they look up to came out and said it was the greatest thing ever and this was amazing, they'd all be there.
Mm-hmm.
It's just peer pressure. It's just high school, except now everyone's an adult.
It would be high comedy to hear their specific answers because they don't seem to know much. Although all these articles tend to, I read a lot of articles about this possible boycott, and they all said that Steve Kerr is one of the most socially aware coaches in all sports, and then some of these players are some of the most socially aware players. Now, what qualifies one to be socially aware? Like, just because I start talking about nuclear physics makes me scientifically aware.
Right.
You have to actually be able to substantiate your point. All of these guys have only gone on rants and called names. None of them have actually said what they disagree with in any policy. The only one that could actually impact them in any way is the fact that Republicans traditionally lower taxes. So they're going to pay fewer taxes to the government. I don't really know what else is even making them so upset.
It'll be a great mystery. that's from the Washington Examiner. If the Warriors skip a visit to Trump's White House, they'll be taking a play from ESPN's failed playbook. It does highlight, though, what's happening in the nation, and that's another write-up that you have from townhall.com. Can a divided America survive? The division between, I guess if you want to make it more simple, just conservative and liberal, but it's probably more than that, but that's at least one way to divide it. It is very stark, and we see it in sports, we see it in the news talk shows, and now, sadly, we see it in actual violence breaking out. And so they're asking this question, can a divided America survive? What's their takeaway?
Well, it does seem like the United States is reaching the end of its time because of other historically great empires that have fallen around this point, around 250 years or even before that. And if you just look around at what is going on in the country, it would make sense that the United States is on the verge of collapse as well. The fact that there are basically two different Americas, you have basically all of the liberals, for the most part, living in the coastal areas, which makes up less than 10% of the nation's landmass. And then you have about an equal number of people living throughout the entire rest of the country, a lot more spread out. And because the different people of different beliefs are living in different parts of the country, they're watching different news programs or taking in news in different ways. They have different types of jobs. They have different culture, economics, social views. And now there's just a level of intolerance for people who don't agree with each other. Really, that does show that it is basically two nations within one.
Yeah, and that's probably a lot of people that aren't totally in one camp or the other. They're just kind of neutral, maybe. But because I think of the environment and the talk shows and that type of thing, and the media, it does feel like they're kind of forcing people to a side. You know, they're picking teams or something. And I think there's a lot of people that probably, you know, like a little bit on one side, a little bit on the other side, but you can't really do that in this climate, because it seems like you have to be one or the other, and you have to be very much one way or the other with it. There doesn't seem to be a lot of middle ground.
Well, it reminds me of a story from the American Civil War. Oftentimes during the war, in between battles, Confederates and Union soldiers would talk with each other, and they would exchange goods. The Yankees would get cigars from the South, and then the Yankees would give coffee to the Confederacy, and they would swap. And after talking with each other, one account says that if us two fellows had sat down, we could have solved the war in 30 minutes. So with the average person, they're caught in a bigger vortex of these big forces and of their leaders making decisions, when they themselves have no personal antagonism, maybe. I think that's probably a larger group than maybe what most think. But then you do have some people who are very strong-willed on this issue. And I think, like you mentioned, and Grant, like you said, society is becoming so polarized that it's not safe to sit on the fence or to be neutral or say, like, hey, I don't agree with either of you, because you have to pick a side, just like all those people did in the American Civil War. Even if they didn't care about slavery or they cared about a lot of different things, you have to choose a side.
Well, the Civil War did separate families and friends because in a lot of cases they had to fight for whichever side, depending on where they were living at the time. In a lot of cases, I believe it was General Robert E. Lee didn't personally agree with some of the tenets of the Confederacy, but he was from down there and he fought for that budding new country. It didn't mean that he necessarily agreed with everything. And just because the family and friends were split up fighting on different sides, they actually still loved each other. And they hated the fact that fathers were on one side and brothers were on the other. But in the case of now, it's pretty extreme, because we've had a lot of articles about Thanksgiving being separated. There's actually a hatred there where, yes, the country is being split between families, and yet it's not even they don't even love each other anymore either.
Yeah, there's and I guess the ultimate question would be, just looking at it historically, does any group or nation that becomes divided, do they survive? Any thoughts? Is there ever a group that's been divided that survives? I can't think of one.
Only if one side wins in the Civil War.
Sure.
I mean,
right. You have to end the division at some point, or else you don't exist as you did before.
Because we have gotten to the point where one side is almost militant, the way that they persecute anyone who disagrees with them. The left in this country is not accepting any differing points of view. That's where you cannot compromise with a group of people like that, and it just gets difficult to really figure out how we can move forward peacefully. We're to the point where even in politics, where there should be some sort of civil discourse, it's common to see people vote along party lines every single time, no matter what the issue is or what type of compromise could have been made. The battle lines are drawn. There's no one going to budge either way.
I was watching a news report yesterday. They were talking about I don't know. I don't remember the gentleman's name, but he's a politician. And even before yesterday's event with that shooting, he said that he no longer does town hall meetings with people. He'll do it video conference because it's not safe to go out, in his estimation anyway, and face people because there's so much anger at times. And he's talking to people that in most cases would agree with him, that he represents them, but that you'll have a few that don't agree with him in the same way. And so you have those situations now where just for their own safety, they're doing a video conference or something like that. And that was even before yesterday's situation. So that, you know, we were talking about it yesterday, Abraham, how you'd be pretty nervous right now if you were a politician, just, you know, hopefully nothing like this happens again, but I think that'd be kind of naive to think that there'll never be an incident. When you're going out and you know that the people you're trying to get to vote for you are very much divided in a pretty much a 50-50 split, you're going to make half of them mad, right? Half are going to be strongly against you no matter what. It's as bad, really, as, like, say, walking around if you had to wear an R or a D on your shirt. You know, which one are you? And it's almost that bad because that's all people tend to see. Now, they don't even think, like, well, what does this particular politician have to say? It's just like, oh, you're part of that party, or oh, you're part of that party. And then that's where all the thinking comes from, or it's based upon, I think, in a lot of cases. So very not a good situation at all. We have a great book at thetrumpet.com, America Under Attack, that very popular. Many people have requested it. Now is a great time to read it.
Yes, and it really is important at this time when we had a president who swung the country radically to the left until just being replaced recently. And now that's going to require it swinging radically back to the right, just in terms of presidential power and trying to undo a lot of unconstitutional actions of the last presidency. People are becoming more polarized. The fact that there's an onslaught of illegal immigration now, for example, that's taking certain people's jobs, but it's not taking other people's jobs. So one group cares about illegal immigration, the other one does not. There are plenty of examples like that where there's just two groups that just cannot see any issue the same way.
Yeah, it's very divisive, as I think everybody knows. That's townhall.com. Can divided America survive? That is the question. You know, another facet of that's very interesting is because there's such a strong push against the current administration, what's the pushback going to be, if there is one? I mean, there are people, even yesterday, just looking at different commentators, people calling for very strong pushback, like, you know, eliminate certain things like, well, I don't know. I don't think they went as far as to say freedom of speech, but basically, you know, make sure no one can say anything about this, this, or this. And while I understand what they're saying at some level, that's pretty frightening, too. And that's where we are, because there's such a extreme push against one group. What if the other group pushes back? What do you have? I mean, neither one of those are good. And I think that's kind of what we're sitting in right now.
Yeah, and in democracy, if you lose the middle ground, then basically all is lost, because democracy is supposed to be a balancing act between different ideas, policies, different actions. And if the scale tips too far in one direction, it's so hard to get it back that usually it causes damage that can't be easily fixed.
Yeah, that's interesting. Abe, you've got a quick tech note for us here before we get into your final story on Churchill. And this is, we've talked about the development of different technologies. Of course, drones are one of those. And sometimes they can be really frightening or irritating, but they can be helpful too. This is from CTV News. Drones carrying defibrillators could aid heart emergencies. So basically a little ambulance in the sky, so to speak.
Yeah, they've been researching this. If someone has a cardiac event on the street in a city or in some populous area, then they can, what they're working on is sending out drones to respond and bring a defibrillator so someone can help them out right away. Because in that sort of situation, every minute counts for that person's life.
Yeah.
And so far they've tested 18 cardiac arrests. The defibrillator hasn't been used on anyone, but they're just testing how fast they can get there. And the drones can usually get there within 5 minutes While most times it takes about 17 minutes for an ambulance to arrive.
Right. I was driving through Fort Worth, like I was mentioning the other day on the weekend, a lot of construction, a lot of traffic jams. And I was going, I was heading south, and in the northbound lane, they were just backed up like crazy. And there's an ambulance sitting there with those lights going, and people are like, what do you want, you know, what can they do? And so this really highlights that. I mean, sometimes nobody can move, and you just sit there. I don't know if they had somebody in the vehicle or if they were going to get them, but they're not going anywhere because there's nowhere to go, so they had to sit there like everybody.
Yeah, exactly. That's a great point, that these drones could really help in emergency situations because there's no nothing blocking the air channels to get there. And so there are about 6 million people a year that die from a cardiac arrest or from a heart attack. And so these drones, if they're successful and if they have to do some more field testing with them, but it could really make a big impact. And I think this is exciting because it can really help people have a chance to survive these sorts of tragic happenings. And it's a good use of technology. It's a positive use instead of some of the crazy things we've seen drones used for.
Right. Yeah. But then you're going to have to regulate that, who uses the space. And who, you know, that. So that'll be interesting. But that could be a potentially good use for those. This next one, this last piece you have today, I'm really interested to hear about this. It sounds unbelievable. It's from the Times. Brian Cox, he says, I based my Churchill on Stewie from Family Guy, the star of a new biopic of the wartime prime minister, on why he took his inspiration from a U.S. cartoon toddler. I'm not super familiar with Family Guy. I have seen at least a commercial or maybe a passing scene. And this is a little baby, right? And
yes.
He's a smart mouth cartoon baby.
And he's evil.
And he's evil.
Kind of.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so this guy that's playing Winston Churchill, he's using that cartoon character as his inspiration.
Yeah, so this is the Churchill movie we've talked about a couple times. It comes out tomorrow in the United States, I believe, June 16th.
You won't be at work tomorrow, I guess?
Don't worry. I should get paid. I'm only going to watch that movie if I get paid for it. So, but anyway, we've already pointed out a lot of the historical inaccuracies and just a lot of the just a terrible portrayal of his character. And I think this article goes a long way to showing why it's such a pile of rubbish, because he's basing at least part of his preparation for playing Winston Churchill. He based it off of a crass cartoon character, and so this is what he did. He did other preparation. He also read a lot about Churchill. He read a lot of books. He did other things. So this isn't exclusively what he did, but this is what he. Is what he says in the article. Stewie is brilliant, he says. His parents don't understand him, and he has the sensibility that's unlike anything around him, and he has a rich fantasy life and a great intellectual relationship with Brian the dog. When I first saw it, I was preparing for Churchill and thought, wow, there's so much of Churchill in that. It was inspirational. So I will admit I've seen a couple episodes of Family Guy, watching at friends' houses and stuff like that. And, they're Churchill and Stewie, the little man baby. They're two. They're on the opposite, farthest possible ends of the spectrum of human behavior possible. In the show, the little baby kills people. He builds time machines, and he has
homosexual tendencies and dresses up like a woman a lot of the time.
Yeah. So I mean, this is the person they're basing. He thought that resembled Churchill, and the big reason why is, as he says further down, is he thinks, based off of his own personal opinions, that Churchill was a little child trapped in World War II trying to play grown up. That's what he thought Churchill was. And I don't know where he got that from or why he has that opinion, but it's the furthest from the truth, especially when you realize what Churchill did in his long life, the battles he fought in. He wasn't a scared little boy. He was a warrior, and to equate him to some kind of perverse character on a cartoon show is, I think it's just a travesty.
Yeah, that's terrible. Well, that's a lot of Well, there's just a lot of bad things in the entertainment culture in the U.S., just a lot of garbage. And instead of people, in a lot of cases, instead of spending their time reading maybe some good history, people do, I guess, tend to watch shows like this. It's just a perversion of thinking. Like, it doesn't, it's just strange. And it's just sad, too. You think about the great things in man's history. Now, war is not one of those things, but I mean the fact that somebody would stand up and fight for their nation, be used to save their nation, people's lives, to be a warrior, to fight for what matters, to protect his home, his fight for the king and country. And then you have some actor who, I don't know anything about this fellow, but obviously he will not be remembered in history as somebody like Churchill. And here he has his big take on it, and it's a perversion. It's just really, I can't even think of the words for it. It's just very poorly executed, poorly thought out, I guess.
Yeah. Stewie really doesn't stand for anything good. Meanwhile, Churchill saved Western civilization. Stewie doesn't create anything except for, like, high-tech devices to try to kill his own mother with. And Churchill produced dozens of historical works that we can actually benefit from. And if people actually read those, we could avoid some pretty big problems coming up here.
Yeah, I think what's kind of like putting my brain into like lockup mode here is that to even watch that show and then look at that, it's just like the people. I don't want to get too critical, but it's just nonsense. It's just silliness, and that might be putting it nicely, I guess. And then you're making this movie about a great historical character, and you're trying to tie the two together. I don't know, like, what's the equivalent of that? Is it like, you know, playing Mozart and then, you know, hitting a xylophone? I mean, it's what's the equivalent? It's just such a different world in terms of, like, the elevation of thinking and action versus just this... just nonsense, like a children. I know it's not a children's cartoon, but it is just foolishness. I'm having a hard time putting these two things together.
Yeah, well, to me, it's just nonsense, and I don't know what he was thinking, but it just shows that there's just a incomplete ignorance of understanding who Winston Churchill is. A lot of American film critics think Brian Cox should win an Oscar for his performance in the movie, which I think is just ridiculous.
They have to give it to Stewie.
Yeah. Well, and I'm sure he's won awards in the past, but it's because I'm writing a article on Churchill, and Isaiah Berlin said to understand Churchill, you have to understand history, that Churchill was not a product of his childhood, of his times, of his friends or anything. He was a product of hundreds of years of British history and of the British Empire. And that's what he based his character on, who he became. He based it off of the heroic virtues of what made Britain great, and how Britain survived several centuries of fighting tyrants and being the underdog on their island. And so that's what Churchill was. He wasn't playing a fantasy game. He wasn't playing growing up. And there's some stories just of him during the Blitz and Battle of Britain where... he was touring bombed out London, and people would rush around him and say, like, oh, we're okay. And some of them asked him, like, well, when are we going to get the Germans? And he would turn around and wave his walking stick in their face and say, you leave that to me because we're going to get them. Because he was upset at what he was doing, and he understood they had to take the offensive to destroy Nazi Germany. And so when you read those stories, there's no scared child there. He was a man, and he's seen several people die right beside him. He understood what war was. And so to use a cartoon, this isn't entirely what he did, but to use a cartoon character and think there's some insight, especially the one in Family Guy, insight into the greatest man probably who's ever lived, Carnally. It's just, I don't know, it's just, I think, irresponsible. And it's only making the problem worse of feeding a historically ignorant generation just more and more lies about a man who represents something far greater than what exists today.
Yeah, yeah, it's not a reflection on Churchill, it's a reflection on our society.
Yeah.
The fact that I think what they're doing, I don't know if they do it intentionally or if they're just don't know what they're doing, but they're taking the greats that people should look to as an example. But because we in no way would follow that example today, because the leaders are too scared today. They are actually children in most cases today. They have to drag them down. That's just human nature, right? If somebody does something really well, but you don't want to do it, or you're afraid or whatever, you drag them down. Everybody has that experience, I guess, whether it's in the schoolyard or it's something bigger like this. And that's all they're doing is they're just trying to drag down a great historical example and put it in the mud with everything else to say, yeah, see, it wasn't so great. Because I don't know if they feel inferior or they're afraid or they just hate the history or what it is, a combination of all of it. But you want to talk about somebody being a child, I don't think this guy should be talking about Winston Churchill.
Yeah, well, that's the thing with our society is all the great historical leaders of the past who are elevated above us, something that we should seek to elevate ourselves by following their example. We put them down at our level, like you said, and because it justifies our culture, justifies our inadequacies and our sins, by making someone who's better than us at our same level, when really they're not saying Churchill didn't have his problems, but he is a great man. I don't think anyone can question that. And so when you drag him down to the level of some little perverse man child on a cartoon show, you're doing a great disservice to trying to create an image and an example young people can follow. Because, I mean, by watching Family Guy, you're not going to have any great leaders emerge from that. I mean, like the stories we've been talking about today, a lot of these reasons why this nation is divided is because of our sick culture and society. But if we do look to history, especially Bible history and men like Churchill, we can start to see some ways that we can start to recover.
Yeah, really, really strange. That's all the time we have for today on Trumpet Radio Live. Thanks for joining us. Make sure you listen for the Key of David program, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show coming up as well. For myself, Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondeau, enjoy the rest of your Thursday. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Listening to Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG.